session number 9211, reel 4.
Squadron Leader Curtis, Reel 4. I think you were describing to me the state of mind you were in when you were on a bombing run.
Yes, as I said earlier on, as long as you were busy, you never thought about anything except for the job that you were doing. But when it came to the bombing run and your duties, to a greater extent, were finished, it was then came the realization that you were very vulnerable and people were actually trying to kill you. As an example of tension, in the radio operator's cabin, or quite adjacent to it, was a steel pole, presumably a support of some sort. Frankly, I used to hang on to this like grim death. And I've always said that if anyone ever found that steel pole, they'd find my fingerprints embedded in it. And I'm not joking. One really did. It did come home very forcibly what was going on at that particular time. Everyone, I'm sure, will agree that that is the time that you dreaded on that bombing run. Be it long or short.
Were you equally busy on the flight home to what you'd been on the flight out?
Oh yes, exactly the same. One kept a permanent listening watch all the time one was airborne until one landed. Because, as you'll appreciate, one could easily get a diversion. As we know, the United Kingdom, the weather is always very dodgy and often one got a diversion call because of bad weather back in UK. It was a question of a permanent listening out brief. All the messages, of course, came through in code. And this was one of the times when we felt we were really, really helping, because the number of times that one was diverted was very great. And if one hadn't have had the wireless operator there to take this thing, well, we could probably lost a lot more aircraft.
Was there relatively more for you to do on a night raid or a daylight raid?
I think it was equal, no different as far as I can remember, except there were, even when you were listening out on a daylight raid, you could say, again, be of some use, or you could be of some use to the pilot or navigator, as you had an astrodome that you could look out of and see quite clearly, and map read. At the same time, you were always a help to the air gunners, because you could scan the sky at the same time in case of enemy aircraft. So equally, I think.
Do you remember the time when the mid-upper turrets were removed for streamlining?
Yes, I do.
Well, what difference did that make to the performance of the aircraft?
It certainly gave you, I think, a little bit more extra airspeed. On the other hand, we were also conscious of the fact that it also lost a pair of eyes not scanning all the time. So we looked upon that with some misgivings, I must confess. But usually, when the mid-upper turret was removed, the mid-upper gunner used to sit in the front turret and do his thing there.
When you were on a bombing run, which members of the crew would be actively engaged, and which would be in a similar position to yourself, of just having
just
to
sit there
and wait?
The people involved Obviously, the bomb aimer, who really was in charge of the aircraft at that, on the bombing run. The obviously the pilot, and that was it really. The engineer, the navigator, the wireless operator, and the gunners just had to sit there and wait.
You described having a steel pole beside your cabin. Mm-hmm. What was your cabin like? How was it furnished and laid out?
Very small. The one good thing about the cabin, as I've said before, was the fact that you could control the hot or cold air. And obviously you could get it to suit you, but not the rest of the crew. Immediately in front of you, obviously, was the transmitter receiver. How can I describe it? I suppose in a way, when you had the curtain drawn, it was just like sitting in a box. But you were oblivious to whatever. You were concentrating so hard all the time. You were oblivious to really your surroundings.
You didn't feel claustrophobic?
No. 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 Not personally. No.
Once you were in the aircraft, did you stay in your cabin all the time? Or did you ever step out of it and move around?
No. There were certain times when one could step outside. And generally one then went in the Astrodome to, as I said before, to try to help possibly to map read or to give extra assistance to the gunners. But this didn't happen on every trip. It depended as to what the trip was and the time of night or day, and also what the instructions were given on as regards signals, because even though you were listening out all the time, you could still get outside the cabin with the and still be connected to the radio and the intercom, even though you were outside the cabin in the Astrodome.
You had a headset and a long lead, did you?
That's right. That's right.
You were mentioning that you did some flights with the Americans while you were at Cagliari in Sardinia.
Well, not flights, just one. It was at a time when we had the engineer in hospital and we were somewhat at a loose end. So we were invited, I think that's the word, by the Americans who were flying at that time. I don't know their number, but we call them Mitchells. And did a raid. Honestly, I can't remember where it was. A daylight raid on, it was a coastal installation, I think, of some sort, on the Italian coast, I think, from memory. Our impression was that they were very good, efficient. Everything went very well. No opposition, as it happens, thank goodness, and all ended up quite happily.
What was their aircraft like in the inside compared to yours?
Not as much space at all. I mean, it was only a twin-engined aircraft, much smaller. I don't know what the range was, but the interesting thing was, as far as we were concerned, is that they issued one with flak suits and flak helmets, which is a thing that we'd never come across before. Not that we thought this was a bad thing. We were all in favour.
Did they do this raid in formation?
Yes, all in formation.
Yep. What sort of height were they bombing from?
Oh, God. From memory, I think it was at about 15 or 16,000 feet.
And that would have been higher than your normal altitude.
Well, not really, no. Not for the main... people on the squadron who got up very, very high with these high penetration bombs, the Tall Boy and Grand Slam and things like that. No, they really were up high to get the best penetration they possibly could. The low-level thing that was done, I say, was by just the specialised crews who did the marking.
What about the American radio system? Was that similar to yours, or did it have any major distinctions from yours?
The American equipment was the same as that I had used on
You can't remember?
No, I can't remember, no. The impression I got from the American wireless operators were that in no way were they as trained as well as we were. I don't know how long their courses took, but I didn't get much. I wasn't very impressed with the training that they would have appeared to have had compared with the training in the Royal Air Force.
What about the relationship between their pilots and air crew? Was it similar to that? That
can't answer that.
You can't answer that.
No. I just don't know. I just don't know. I really and truly don't know.
Did 617 ever fly in formation when it was doing daylight raids?
Well, let's put this a loose formation. A gaggle is, I think, how it was described. Not the way the Americans flew. We just weren't trained for it. It always amazes me as to how well we did when we were flying these low levels in formation at night. Because they really did remarkably well, the pilots at that flying this, because they weren't trained for it at all.
I'd like to ask you about briefing and debriefing. What sort of briefing would you get as squadron radio leader?
It varied from, obviously, from squadron to squadron, but on 617 it was quite thorough. We had a good rapport with the station signals officer. Our briefing was somewhat consistent, I would have thought, with the briefing that the navigators got from their navigation leader. And the general briefing for all aircrew, which I should think was pretty much the same throughout the Royal Air Force.
Generally speaking, was the quality of intelligence you got at your general briefings good?
It was excellent, particularly the Met people, which is, may sound surprising, but we thought they were very, very good. On many occasions when we've taken off in not in visibility that wasn't too good, by the time we'd got to the target, it had cleared exactly the same way that the Met people forecast. We were very impressed.
Now, you mentioned that when you went off to Russia, you said the communications information you got was pitiful.
That's right.
What sort of information would be covered by that?
Well, we were given charts and lists of radio beacons, together with a system of a very complicated system of contacting stations. My own experience is that when we needed to contact these stations, no matter how hard one tried, one never raised them, or if one did, one never got a reply. Therefore, we could be of absolutely no help whatsoever to the navigator on this occasion. And he, in all conscience, I think, was struggling enough because of from what I gather, the fairly inadequate maps that were provided. Simply because I think that so much of Russia was probably uncharted anyway.
So you would normally expect to get a list of stations that you could call up if you needed help, would you?
That's right. Quite a comprehensive list. I know that I remember, and one did get quite a good range from these sets that we had. I remember on an occasion flying very low in or near Italy / Corsica, that I contacted UK base quite readily, and it came through loud and clear. In fact, this was discussed when we got back to England by certain people connected with signals from fairly high up, I think, as to how good the reception and everything else was. I must confess I was absolutely amazed, but it came through loud and clear. Excellent.
Were there meteorological or other circumstances which could adversely affect radio communication?
Oh, yes, absolutely. One of the big problems, of course, particularly during the winter, flying at certain levels. I remember one incident when we were flying through some rather nasty weather, and we had our first experience of the St. Elmo's fire, which was quite eerie at the time, which took out, at least temporarily, all radio communication altogether. This was unusual, to say the least.
Would that also have affected the squadron radio net?
I don't think so. I think it was fairly localised to the aircraft.
When you got back, what sort of debriefing would you have?
Very thorough. I think the main objective of getting people debriefed quickly is so that one will get the facts quickly, because one's memory does tend to zigzag around, as we all know. And I think that was the reason for this. We were told to give as clear and concise our opinions of the raid, and what we saw and what we think was happening, to the best of our ability.
Did they ever show any special interest in radio aspects of any operation?
No, not really, except in the early days when we were trying to jam night fighters and things. In early 1943, we were given certain wavelengths to try to counter fighter activity again, and because at that particular time we were given all sorts of different information, some of which I put a big question mark against now. The one that stuck in my mind was the question that we were told to look out for a thing called Scarecrow, that we were told was a spoof put up by the Germans to simulate aircraft exploding. It wasn't until after the war that I found there was no such thing as Scarecrow. It really was aircraft exploding that we could see. Here again, a bit of the old psychological type thing going on.
Did you find that as the war went on, the Germans diversified and intensified attempts to interfere with your radio?
No, and probably the reason for that is that being a small specialised force attacking small individual targets, I don't think they gave us the same attention as they would to main force, where they knew there were hundreds and hundreds of aircraft coming across. And don't forget that most of our stuff at that particular time was done low level anyway, till one got comparatively near the target. No, I think that where they concentrated was on the main force squadrons.
What were your relations with your ground crew like?
Excellent. I think they appreciated what we were doing, and we certainly appreciated what they were doing for us, because here again, it was a joint thing. They knew what we had to do, and we knew that we couldn't do without them. No, they were very good and worked terrible hours, but it obviously gave them a sense of pride, I think, in the squadron, just as much as the aircrew.
What was the centre of your social life?
if by centre you mean what was the main place that we hung out, is that what you mean? Or Lincoln mainly. Lincoln and Boston in Lincolnshire.
I was thinking more in terms of whether, when you were on the loose, as it were, you would mainly be with your own air crew, or whether you would be a part of the officer's mess, or whether it would be air crew plus ground crew, or what would it be? Who did you hang around with?
No. No, obviously it varied from different people. I mean, basically, if you were in the officer's mess, you were in the officer's mess. I think if you were in the sergeant's mess, they were in the sergeant's mess. But when one went out to town, then obviously one went as a crew. There was no difference in rank, as far as I can remember. Didn't come into it at all.
There's no sense of status then?
No, no.
When did you actually get commissioned?
I was commissioned in early 1942.
And did you find that made a big difference at that time?
Not really, and the reason for that is this, is because most of the time when I flew in the early days, all aircrew, not all aircrew, but most aircrew were NCOs anyway. And I remember that when I was commissioned, that I was the only commissioned member of my crew. In fact, this question of status didn't really come into it, except for a time that I remember being made captain of aircraft, which surprised me, but only because of my experience, nothing to do with rank. Obviously, if you'd had experience, you wanted to stay alive, and you obviously advised the pilot in particular, basically, just what to do, because they'd never been before. And initially, most of them, when they first started, they just literally flew straight and level, and that was it. You had to tell them to sort of throw the thing around a bit and weave and dodge. But rank, no, never came into it.
What was your accommodation like when you were 617?
Accommodation was very good. In the initial stages, of course, we were at a peacetime establishment, Scampton. And after that, we moved to Coningsby again, which is a peacetime establishment. And it was only when we moved to Woodhall Spa that we were put in a hotel that had obviously been presumably commandeered by the Royal Air Force for the and used as an officer's mess. But the accommodation was excellent.
And what about the food?
Food was at times a bit sparse, but one tended to throw a bit of money in the kitty and. People used to go around, the messing officer, if he was any good, went around and got a little bit of extra bought in for us.
He was a Lincolnshire poacher, was he?
He was definitely a Lincolnshire poacher, yes. Yes.
What about drink? Was there enough of that?
Oh, yes. The interesting thing is that, thinking back on this about drinking during the war, most people just drank beer. And beer was rather an innocuous type of thing at that time. You had to drink an awful lot of it before you got merry, shall we put. But that was one of the things that was needed most. A place to be able to go away from the station, to a pub where you could relax and forget it all. We have a lot to be grateful for the English pub.
Were there rules about drinking before flying?
Oh, yes. Very, very, very strict. But you didn't have to be told. You knew that someone over there was going to try to kill you. And you knew you needed all your wits about you. Nobody but an idiot would go out there and drink before. I never met anyone all the time I was in the Air Force while flying drank. Never.
It has been said that the fact that you were alternating between reasonable comfort and safety on the station and then considerable discomfort and danger when in the air, and you're alternating fairly quickly, created a particular mental strain on air crews. Did you find that was the case?
I think it affected people in different ways. Speaking personally, I think that one accepted the fact that you wouldn't come back from this war. I did. I accepted it. And once I'd accepted that, I didn't have any problems. Of course you were frightened. Anyone that says he wasn't, well, he's either lying or he's an idiot. But I felt that most people accepted the fact that they probably wouldn't come back. And that helped an awful lot.
Was there anything else you could do other than this acceptance, which sounds like the Christian virtue of resignation? But other than that, was there anything you could do to not to, to eliminate your fear, but to control and contain it so that it didn't inhibit your efficiency?
No, not really. I think basically that you knew what you were going to do was dangerous. You knew you might get killed. And you were frightened. But you knew it had to be done, so you did it.
Did you find that as time went on you got relatively less frightened or more frightened?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I certainly didn't get less frightened. No, I certainly didn't get less frightened. But I say it was the... As time went on, maybe you thought, well, they just can't get me anymore. You know, they just can't get me. I think that at the end of my flying on a squadron, I was probably starting to get a twitch. My old adjutant says I was. I didn't realise I was. In fact, when I was posted, much against my will, by presumably squadron commander, I really did resent it bitterly. In fact, in a way now, I wish I'd have taken up the opportunity of staying on the squadron in a non-flying capacity to assist the... our talking bomb, we had a specialist expert on the SABS bomb site who wanted me to stay on as his assistant, even though I knew nothing about the thing, but I could have learned, I suppose. But that's the one thing that sticks in my craw a little bit. I didn't want to leave the squadron.
Perhaps you got used to the idea of getting killed. Is that a possibility?
Oh, I think so. I think that one accept. I think you accepted that, and once you accepted that, it helped an awful lot. Prayer, yes, sometimes that came into it. I prayed time to time, still do. And that certainly helped.